Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. We're at Open Book, and you know, we love book festivals because we just get to meet the most amazing authors.
All of our faves!
And like today, I think this has been a much awaited podcast.
Yo, guys.
So people are going to be like, yes, finally, like we've been waiting for this, right? Mm. But I think like before the recording of the podcast was quite interesting, because I feel this podcast seems to be happening at the right time, because we've been trying to get a podcast, but there's been a week in South Africa, and this week has made us question a lot of things, and you know, to be in conversation with you in this week seems to be, you know, like the stars aligning in some ways. I will allow Alma to, you know, do the honors of welcoming you onto our podcast.
I don't even know if I have enough English. really, I don't know if I have enough English, but we are so honored to welcome onto the podcast the amazing, the highly esteemed Prof. Phumla Dineo-Ogola, who is an award-winning gender activist, writer, Black Girl Magic, feminist icon.
Dean of research,
dean of everything that Black girls want to be in the girl. to the podcast, and also I really want to emphasize this esteemed writer. I think it's so important that we honor the work that's been done by Prof, and we're so happy to have you on the podcast. This has been like 2 years in the making. We've been fangirling forever. As long as we started the podcast, we wanted to have you on the podcast. And the clock on all is right, that in this week particularly, it's so poignant to have Prof on the show and to really discuss this wide-ranging topic. And I think that if there is a podcast just from this week that people need to listen to,
it will be this. Yeah. How are you doing, Prof?
The Cheeky Natives.
I can't believe. Thank you so much. I am thrilled to finally be on Cheeky Natives. I've been feeling a little bit left out.
We were getting ourselves
so
ready.
I am very excited. I'm like, oh my God, I've made it in life. I'm on Cheeky Natives. Thank you so much for having me.
I think before we start, just some reflections about the week that's been happening. I mean, for me, I've been tired. And I think part of the tired is like, we seem to have some form of selective amnesia, because this isn't the first time that we're marching. This isn't the first time a Black woman has been killed. But I think there's something particular about this moment, is that we often talk about Black women not being safe anywhere in the world, but would we have imagined that a Black woman would not have been saved at a post office?
That's just the thing. You know, I feel like at some level, many of us in this country, certainly Black women, certainly queer people, certainly gender non-conforming people, gender fluid people of various, you know, we've been saying this so many times, and I think there's a certain level of, for me, fatigue. You know, I feel like we have been here so many times before. I'm tired of the people whose names we remember, and then the people whose names we don't remember, or we remember privately because they didn't make it into the spotlight. But my frustration certainly is, you know, I think this week with Uyinene and Jess and Baby Lee and you know, Ayaka, and so many instances of rape, sexual assault, killing in the midst of kind of the outbreak of extreme violence in the Johannesburg and Tshwane CBDs as well. That I just, it feels a little more hopeless than usual. And also the question I suppose I keep asking myself is, what else are we going to do? And I don't, I mean, we have marched, we have ideas, we have analysis of what is going on, what is needed. We have 24 demands that are very specific. And that's just the most recent instance. And so I think the frustration is around the continued expectation that the people who are being brutalized and killed off have to bear this responsibility. It honestly feels like the people with the structural power, not just men in this country, but the people we elect into positions who have real power just don't care. And that's, there's been a bit of that before for me, but this week, that's really been the dominant feeling.
And I agree with that. I mean, I was saying to Lotlokonolo, you know, I am always super cautious. I think just as a woman in this country, you are cautious in the ways that you navigate certain spaces. But when even an errand, like a routine errand, like going to the post office, can lead to your rape and murder, then at which point do we draw the line? Like, at which point do we feel like we've reached the ceiling and there is really no coming back? Like, but also, the feelings of hopelessness are quite wide-ranging, and in some ways they actually feel almost disarming, like there's just nothing more that we can do. And in moments like this, and in the face of times like this, what do you draw on? What do you do in moments like this? Like, honestly, because I mean, I was talking to my best friend, and we turned on this Find Your Friends. Like, I knew it was a thing, but I didn't know. Like, now I'm like, oh my God, somebody needs to know where you are at every point, so that, not because they're going to do anything, but so they know where to start looking for you in case something happens to you.
Absolutely. I mean, my sister sent everybody in the family the exact app, so that we can all find each other in the midst of this. And it seems to me that we're fighting, but at the same time, we can't stop taking on the responsibility of monitoring ourselves and of doing all of this work in you know, I mean, we are an open book, and I come several, you know, I come every year, and I walk around, and I know what it's like to be a woman, you know, but I walk around anyway, even in the evenings between sessions. And this year, for the first time, I was even more aware of, I mean, as I walked between the hotel, just two blocks, and I was so aware of who was behind me, who was coming. I was, you know, the amount of militants that we have to in the hyper, just living in this hyper vigilant life. And of course, the thing that is deeply painful also is that we've been saying there's no safety. We've been saying for forever that all of these scripts about how to make yourself safe are not true, right? It's not, it doesn't protect anyone to, you know, I mean, Boyson several years ago, right? What is the thing that we tell girls often and women? Don't go around alone, don't go around. What did she do? She left with people that she knew, that she'd known for a long time, and they slaughtered her. We say, don't go to certain places, stay in the right part of town. We Nene lived in Claremont, she was in Res, she was in a post office, right? We say to women, leave when it gets abusive. Baby Lee and the doctor whose name has not been released in PE left. They left their partners. They had protection orders, and they got shot, and you know, they got shot and they got killed. We say, leave. You know, the woman whose children were burnt was leaving. You know, was going through a divorce. We say, take self-defense classes. Baby Lee was a karate champ and a boxing champ, but I mean, that stuff that just doesn't protect you against a violent man whose sense of ownership of you is so, it doesn't, you know, a black belt and an undefeated boxing championship does not defend you against a bullet in the face. And so I think what this week has highlighted is just that that there's nothing we can do to protect ourselves, and all of these scripts are a lie. But I think you asked a very important question, Alma, about, well, how do we nourish, how do we
remain hopeful,
how do we, and it's a difficult question to answer this week. But I think we do the things that nourish us, right? Mm. Even if it feels irresponsible, even if it feels indulgent, even if it feels, and those things are going to be different for all of us.
Mm.
I think it's you know, like Audre Lorde says, you know, when we take care of ourselves and self-care, and of course self-care, that word has been so corrupted and capitalized now. It's like, I'm not talking about getting your nails done, and there's nothing wrong with getting, I get my nails done, but that's not quite what self-care is. It has to be more
and lash bath salts that cost 50
exactly, so that stuff is nice, but it has to be more than that. It has to be giving ourselves permission to say, okay, so I'll march, but maybe I'll sit this one out. It has to be saying, you know, maybe I'll sleep in, whatever it is, maybe I won't be apologetic about doing so, giving myself something pleasurable. Maybe I'll go to the book club, my book club. Maybe I will have something, I will have that silly time with my friends that seems, that the pressure to feel bad about wanting that and giving that to ourselves, but we have to, it's in many ways, giving ourselves pleasure. And giving ourselves permission for reprieve really is in allowing ourselves the love and the joy and all the things that make us feel good are the things that keep us alive. And there's no, it's as urgent now as it's ever been.
And I think, Prof, it feels weird to call you Prof, but that's who you are.
It cannot feel weird to you, Letovna, because you are the same person who will drag me to the gods for not using my title. It's so funny. It's like, no, say doctor. I'm like, okay.
I don't know, I was about to say it's Pumlan
Thoughts. He will drag you from.
But you wrote, and I don't want to call it a seminal work because but it was a very important instructive work that you wrote when you wrote Rape, a South African Nightmare. And Rape has been well received. You know, it won the Alan Paton Award. But what was the interest? What was the interest? Why did you think it was important in a moment like 2015, 2016, for you to bring out a book about Rape, a South African Nightmare?
And as a follow-up to that, in 2019, I mean, the book has now been out for about 4 or 5 years, and you've had time to sort of reflect on the moments in which you wrote the book, but the moments in which we find ourselves now. And retrospectively, how do you then feel about the relevance of that book even now? How does it make you feel that that book is still so relevant, is still so topical, is still considered to be such an important work?
Well, so let me try to answer the first one about why, what's going on with me when I'm writing that book. To be honest, I was very taken aback that it resonated so much. You know, I was told, as when I told people that I was writing a book on rape, I was told very often, oh yeah, well, it's an important, we certainly, with given what's going on in South Africa, we need a book on rape, but nobody's gonna buy a book on rape. Nobody really wants to read a book on rape. It's too scary, it's too messy, it's too difficult, it's not. And so I just wrote it. And even as I'm writing it, and I felt compelled to write it, and it sounds very flaky, I know, when I've heard writers say, I felt compelled, I'm just like, what the hell does that even mean, you were compelled to write it? But I did, I felt compelled. And I didn't, I was really 100% sure that I was writing this book because I needed to put all of these things together for myself in my own head, and maybe for the 100 other people who also wanted to
to read it.
I was 100% sure that if it sold more than 100 copies, it would just be because somebody had prescribed to, right? So I've never written anything where I had less expectation of a readership than this book. And I was really, I'd been working on different aspects of kind of anti-rape work for a while. And so for me, it was just, some people journal, and I did as a teenager. But I write sometimes just to make sense of things in my own head, and when I obsess over things, like some of the ways in which I can work through them. And of course, yes, I believe in therapy, and I'm in therapy, but one of the ways is for that. That's what writing does for me sometimes. So it isn't usually a sense of, okay, I'm going to write this because it's important. We need to put this. I mean, sometimes my academic work, I you know, like the journal articles, I have that sense of, this is important. We have to have this conversation. But with Rape, the book, I just, it was like a crazy thing that I needed to do, that I was going to, I had no idea that it would. And I've been incredibly blown away by how much it spoke to people, and how it didn't just become a crazy thing with me and the 100 people that I imagined. So I've been incredibly touched, and I've been absolutely humbled by what people have told me it has meant for them. And of course, I think some of the things that it's done are, sometimes I feel like it gets more credit than, so sometimes people say, we wouldn't have thought to do this particular strategy if we hadn't, and I just don't. So when I had a conversation with some people at the RU reference list at the time, and I was just like, oh my God, I was looking at what they were doing, and I was pained, of course, but I was also thinking, my goodness, I'm learning so much from this moment. And then two of the activists say to me, yes, but this is part of how, you know, this we're in conversation with this book, and when you said this, and I just couldn't see how they, because I was encountering something that was teaching me something.
Yeah.
And it was weird for me to hear them say, yeah, but you taught us something that allowed us to do, you know. So it's, I constantly have, when I see things, I think, oh, this is a moment of radicalization for me. I'm learning so much from this. I'm gonna, oh, I wonder what it means. And then people say, yes, but it's partly. So it's. I'm glad if it offers something that allows all of us to be able to do anti-rape work and anti-patriarchal work in these incredible ways. But yes, I absolutely, and I'm not lying. You know, I mean, I'm not that humble. Right? So if I really thought that it was, I would tell you. But in terms of sitting here four years later and hearing people saying, oh my God, we need to read this book again. Mm. It's a very strange thing, because I appreciate that people say that, but it's also incredibly frustrating because I think, well, if this book can do, it can be part of this big movement to change things so significantly, and work and not work. Like I've never wanted to be more wrong. I've wanted, as much as, of course I'm a writer, so of course I want to be read, and I, you know, it's nice, the critical acclaim and all these things are lovely. But honestly, nothing would make me happier than for this book to be redundant at the same time, right? Like I think that would be the, and so it pains me. Right, because I've never wanted to be more wrong than to be sitting almost 5 years after the book and feel like we're stuck.
So
it's heavy, because like that's what it is. It's like, it's 4 years later, like,
and the book is potentially even more relevant now than it was even at the time that it was written. You know, we've had the Me Too movements, we've had the RU reference list.
We've had Fees Must Fall.
We've had Fees Rose Must Fall. Fall. And we've had Rose Must Fall. We've had just one week in this country alone where we're almost even running out of space to name these people, like to name the people who have been violated, who have lost their lives, and we're still having this conversation. And it makes you wonder how many more books need to be published, but also how many more women and children need to die before the conversation stops being a conversation and there's an action that's attached to it. And I think so much of what Prof is saying is resonating, because there really there's a sense of frustration. You know, I don't know that we're seeing anything new in 2019 that we weren't seeing in 2016, that we weren't seeing in 2015.
That we haven't once seen in 2005. Like, I just feel like we just keep saying these things over and over again. But Prof, I really want to commend you for Rape. I think that what you did with the Rape is, you know, because we think about rape as a legal definition, right? And we think about like what the law says rape is. But I think what Rape, A South African Nightmare really did was to be like, hello, like, it's not only about a definition or non-consensual sex or penetration. It's also about power, right? And the vestiges of the different power, right? It's how does rape constitute itself in the lives of black women in comparison to the lives of white women? So performing, doing that intersectional dynamics, and I really want to commend you for that, because like it's contextualizing the South Africa that we live in, and being like, yes, it affects all of us, but there are people it particularly affects because of patriarchy, because of culture, because of tradition, because of religion, and because of power. So thank you very much for that. For me, like, When I refer back to rape, and when people ask me what I think about rape, I'm like, just read the book, because you do this thing where you're like, power is at the central point of violation.
And also to give a language, right? I mean, before I knew about intersectionality, so I read the book before I knew about intersectionality, but it prompted me to ask certain questions. I think even as a doctor, as to why certain women are presenting more than others with certain things. Why do you have women who are often coming in with stories of gender-based violence? Why? I mean, because we have these very lofty ideals, like, oh, just leave, you know, and that's a conversation that happens often. Oh, just leave. Why do you stay with this person if you don't? But rape made me ask myself certain questions, like, about power, about what it means to be in systems that continuously leave you at the bottom of the food chain, what it means to continuously be entrenched in these systems that really leave you in so many ways powerless, right? And even in the ways that we think that people can seek assistance, how we further then violate people. And it completely changed the way that I interacted with women who had been violated. And it was so important, because I think that in many ways our curricula just at university level is not humanized, it's not contextualized. So you think about sexual assault as like a class, like in med school, it was like a forensic thing that you did, and there was a J88, and you fill in a J88, and everybody goes off on their merry way, and you like hope things work out, and if they don't, I mean, it's really unfortunate, you know. But rape, a South African nightmare, made you realize that the woman who walked into your consultation room
are not forensic people.
They're actual people that those statistics that you hear about South African women and their experiences of sexual assault are not out there, that it's not like a certain group of people that you can divorce yourself from, that it's real. And I think that in many ways, the ways that people are feeling now about feeling that this violence is close to home, they absolutely cannot believe that somebody went to a post office was violated, is the reality for so many black women in this country, that you were on your way to taking a taxi to go to work and somebody raped you, and the taxi stop is not going to move because you were raped. That every day now, when you need to go to work, you will pass that taxi. Like,
absolutely.
That when there was a woman who described how she was raped on her way to the clinic to fetch her medication. The bus stop hasn't moved. No. So every day, every month, when she collects her medication, she goes past that very bus stop, and it's the ways in which rape really is a South African nightmare. That there are women who are just trapped in this perpetual nightmare of what it means to be black and poor and at the mercy of all of these systems that continuously just rob you of your power, of your autonomy, that this body does not belong to you.
Absolutely. And then there are women who are being raped in their homes.
Yes.
Right? Over and over and over again. And so what does it mean? To continue to think about it as though there's some safe space, you know, like there is no safe space. And of course the work that happens in the different silos is important, right? It's not what's a problem is the silo-ness of the silos, right? But I mean, of course the J88 is important, and of course having a doctor going to Alma when you've been raped and having Alma help you versus perhaps a doctor who is not as sympathetic, who's a rape apologist or perhaps a rapist himself, is a radically different, you know, and you need that, of course, in order to be able to survive differently, and in order to be able to make certain other decisions and the same thing, you know, with how you interface with them. And of course, having been someone who in my 20s was at rape crisis and so all of these things are important, right? It's important to be able to provide the crisis counseling. It's important to be able to have wonderful, empathetic, politicized doctors when you collect the evidence. it's important to be able to and to reflect about what that means for medicine, and reflect on what that means for counseling and so on. And I think that, so I'm glad if we're having those conversations across the institutions and across the spaces that are trying to intervene in a different way, and perhaps developing different kinds of strategies. I wonder about the people who don't think that this is their problem, though, right? So I think those of us who are trying to intervene in the problem, who care, are evolving and mutating and self-reflecting and stretching ourselves and contorting. And then there are people who just like, in perpetual performance of shock and helplessness. And I'm thinking, but how can you be... And also the frustration, I mean, increasingly the frustration for me is, of course I'm frustrated at the small level in the sense that, you know, and I'm a mother of boys. So I'm constantly thinking about every single thing about how you raise boys, how, and I, you know, I taught for 25 years and I'll teach again. I'm not teaching currently for the last 2 years. And I'll teach again. I'm constantly thinking about, you know, kind of gender power and how to use, how you teach differently in ways that force people and challenge people and stretch people and so on. But I'm absolutely gobsmacked by the people who have the institutional power. I mean, I have institutional power, right, in the teaching university environment. You have institutional power in the medical, right? You have institutional power in the legal space, right? Mm. But I'm just gobsmacked by the people who feel absolutely no desire to use their institutional power politically to. And I'm sorry if I'm hopping on this. It's just like my obsession at the moment. Like, are you kidding me? How can you be the president and talk to us as though you're like an average Joe?
Yeah.
Like, and you also, can. You have enormous resources to do something. And we told you what the thing is. So you don't even have to think.
That is literally my problem. My problem is like, did we not have a summit a year ago? Did we not sit out in the summit, this is what happened? Exactly. Did you not sign a declaration? And how are you telling us that you don't have money for an NSP, right? How can you not have money for a national strategic plan on gender-based violence? What do you mean?
Well, the talk, I mean, even just as, before we even go there, right? So when you hear stories about how rape kits are stored in forensic laboratories for years on end, how they're not kept properly, how they're not stored properly, I mean, you know, when you see the stories of how many rape cases make it just from reporting to prosecution, then from prosecution just to sentencing, and those numbers are frightening. And at every single step of that, there are things that can be done to make the process better. So for me, it's the idea that the people feel so divorced from that reality, right? And people feel that that reality is the work of activists and gender activists and other people, that they don't feel that really what is the slaughter of women in this country is a crisis. Like this, that it cannot be business as usual. It cannot be that somebody woke up and people went to work and that life continued. Like in 1 week, we did not have the deaths and the assaults of so many women, of so many missing women. We still don't know. Amahle has been missing for 100 days. We don't know what happened to that 6-year-old. And at every single step, for me, there are things that can be done to improve the process. And I cannot believe that a country that can find money for the most mundane things is unable to locate money to improve forensic laboratories. You can count the number of rape crisis centers in the province. And this is in Gauteng.
I mean, the closure of rape crisis, like Tuzela rape crisis, are closing down because they don't have money. Like, so how are we saying we're taking gender-based finances in this country if we're closing down these centers, right? How are we saying, like, you know, when you spoke about the J88, in my head I'm just like, imagine you're traumatized, right? You've just been subjected to this. You get to the first point of call. For some instances it may be the hospital, for other instances it may be the police station, and the police station says to you, my sister, where's your J88? Right now you, in your trauma, must go to wherever the hospital is to be examined, because there is no system of why can't we, why is the system not victim-centered? Mm. You know, that's my frustration, is like, why is it?
I want to speak about something that Prof also speaks about, and language. And we've had a renewed conversation about language, you know. So in the statement that the, I can't even remember who, it was the government department, mm-hmm. that put it out and said, you know, we need, also shout out to the minister who felt that women must not, must stop falling victim to the scourge. Or what did he say? We, what do women do? We fall victim to scourges or whatever he said. Right, and I mean, it just highlights language, and this is, this is another conversation. I think it's also something that you speak about quite deeply, why the language that we use to describe rape, but also just the patriarchal society that we operate in, is so important. How we continuously shift the responsibility from victim, from
perpetrators,
victim, from perpetrators to yeah. victims. Right. So the onus is on you. So, you know, when people said, oh, she was just going to the post office, I had so many feelings about that. I felt that in many ways some of that is a little bit problematic, right? Because it means that the onus is on you to be seen mm-hmm. at the right places, to be doing the right thing so that you don't get raped. Mm-hmm. So what would have happened if she had been at a club? Would mm-hmm. we have somehow felt that that in some ways makes it more palatable? Mm-hmm. Is it okay? You know what I'm saying? Like, there was so much emphasis on she was just going to the post office, she was just running an mm-hmm. errand. And some of that, I find that language to be very violent, and it's also something that you've spoken about, mm-hmm. Prof, and why you consider language to be so, so important when we describe not only the patriarchal society, but also instances like rape, and mm-hmm. why we continue to perpetuate these kinds of violences against women.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. And rape itself is a language. Mm-hmm. Rape itself is a language, right? And it communicates very clearly to those of us who, for him, it's for, to whom the message is directed. Mm. And it communicates very well and very effectively for perpetrators mm. as well. It works. Mm. It works. And it works so much better than so many other languages that we, you know, and it doesn't matter how dishonest we are about what that work is, you know, it works to serve, to put us in our place. So we know we're not safe. But just in case we forget for one second and we believe our own hype about class can protect us and this can protect us, and if you stay in a nice part of town and you stay in the and you stay and you Clement, right? Like all of it, like Clement post office is as dangerous as a club in the middle of a Cape Town township that's in the middle of multiple intersecting wars. It's the same. it's as dangerous. Turn off of a freeway in your car that's air conditioned is as unsafe when your task team. And this is the thing as well, it's just like, as you say, the lack of the unpreparedness of our institutions. I mean, I went recently, a few months ago, the woman who works in my home, my domestic employee, was stalked and threatened. And I went to the police, and she, you know, I knew that she wasn't gonna, you know, she came and she was in a complete state. And so I said, okay, fine, we're gonna go to the police station. Please, man, I knew the police were not, but it has to be, you know, I felt like, okay, so we're gonna go. And the police were, she must, it'd be terrible if she gets killed, but what are we gonna do? Right? And that's me with my class and my age and my educational privilege, all of my things together brought in solid, right? And it's not me at the forefront, but I'm like, okay, so let's bring all of my stuff as well. And it's just, and she said to me, you know, they would have dismissed me completely if you hadn't come. But I mean, they didn't help.
Yeah.
And they didn't, and I thought, my God, what happens? That our policing seems completely geared to deal with, and one of the women constables actually said, we don't do preventative work.
Yep.
Like we can only deal with a case.
Yeah.
That's the one thing, right? Like we could only by the time the law intervenes, it's too late. But then it's so inadequate, even when it's too late,
yeah.
It's
like, what are you doing?
Exactly. And you know, like, one of the things that drives me, I just remember, because I come from a soccer mad maternal family. my paternal family, like complete, you know, my mom is like a complete soccer fan, like crazy. Like she and my nkunu, and like they you know, anyway. So I'm just thinking about the World Cup.
Yeah.
Right? Of course, we all had to go.
Philip was here.
And I just think, my God, like I was living in Joburg, I couldn't get away from the cops. There were cops
everywhere.
Every bloody where. There were those special courts that were set up for all of these things to deal with criminal offenses that happened or whatever it is, legal issues that arose during the war. So we have the capacity, actually, if we decide that it's a priority.
Exactly. And that's the thing.
But we just don't care. We care, but the people who...
Yeah, I think, Prof, I don't want this to be a Himo Rose podcast, you know. I don't want us to walk or feel like...
What's
a Himo
Rose?
No, a Morose podcast.
Oh, exactly. Sorry, I thought we were mentioning a person.
Like,
that is.
My
notes.
You wrote two books.
Mm.
One, I mean, you wrote many books, but I'm particularly interested in these two books. So one book that you wrote is called A Renegade Named Simpiwe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it felt like a bit of a feminist joy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in some way, reclaiming and being like, it's going to be an ode to Simpiwe Dana.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to speak a bit about that, about a feminist, a renegade named Simpiwe. Mm-hmm. But also, we know you to be quite a professor, to be... A writer who interrogates,
yes.
Right? A writer who interrogates, a writer who does a lot of work. But your latest book is more on the personal side.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to also speak about Reflecting Rogue,
mm-hmm.
because I thought that was also interesting. It's like, we know Professor Pumla as this writer,
mm-hmm.
and then she's like, you know what, actually, Reflecting Rogue. And in Reflecting Rogue, we get bits and pieces of like, sort of, you as a person,
mm-hmm.
and how that person informs the work that you do in your life.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little more about A Renegade Named Simpiwe before we go to Reflecting Rogue.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So then I guess my follow-up question will then come when we speak about Reflecting Rogue, because I think it's interesting that the way that Reflecting Rogue is written is very interesting,
mm-hmm.
because it's intimate in the ways that a memoir,
mm-hmm.
is, but it's also in many ways a reclamation of personhood, because so much of what Reflecting Rogue is about is also about what you choose not to put into the book, and what you choose not to reveal about yourself, and what you choose to reclaim as being personal and being private,
mm-hmm.
right? So people who are expecting salacious stories about some of your time in academia don't receive that, because that's not what's in the book,
mm-hmm.
right? So the decision to include and exclude certain things in many ways is also just a powerful statement, because
mm-hmm.
I think I was telling him that for black women, like activism and being somebody in that activist space means often that people feel that they have full access to you, and that they have full ownership of you, and that's why people on social media can say, but why are the feminists not saying anything about this,
mm-hmm.
right? Because there's a sense of ownership of black women, of black intellects, of black
mm-hmm.
women's ideas, of black women's activism in ways that don't extend to other people,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I found interesting about Reflecting Rogue, was that so much of that was a reclamation of personhood. It was,
mm-hmm.
this is what I choose about my private life to put out there, but this is also what I choose to reclaim as personal, as
mm-hmm.
private, as what you do not have privy to.
Wow, I love the formulation, Alma, a reclamation of personhood. I think you're right, Honor. When I wrote A Renegade Called Simpiwe, I was just... Look, I mean, I like women who are too much. I like women who are just cheeky. I was that girl, right? Like, even as a girl, I like renegades. And of course, Simpiwe Dana is both incredible. I mean, she's absolutely genius and talented and fantastic and gorgeous in so many layered ways, right? And I, you know, just absolutely love her work. And I was absolutely, and I'm drawn to people who don't, who color outside the lines. I just always have been. And so maybe because I imagine that I'm that person.
Yeah.
So, and also because I had crazy parents who didn't try to make me color inside the lines. So maybe, you know, like by the time the policing and trying to squeeze me into those things comes, and I recognize it as that, it's too late. Like I've already fallen, I've already understood the joy of being wonky. So writing that book was incredibly joyful. It was absolutely joyful because I love her work. I love what it says. I love how it sounds. I love, a few people said to me, we expected more like analysis of the jazz. I said, like, I'm not, it wasn't, I don't know how to do musical critique, and that's not what I was doing. I was doing it for me, and I was having fun.
Yeah.
And I was trying to write a portrait of not a, I mean, you know, people wanted me to write. When Melinda first approached me, she said, you know, I would like you to write. I said, I don't write biography, right? It's not, it's not where my talents lie. It's not where my interests are. I'm too untied. Like, I don't, and also I'm not a very good reader of biography, right? Or at least the conventional biography. I said, no, I'm not. I'm going to do a thing on her, but it's not the kind of thing that. And of course, Melinda was very gracious, and she's like, okay, I don't know what you're doing, but fine, we'll do this weird thing that we always. And it was incredible fun writing it. And so, yes, it was joyful.
Mm.
And I suppose I was also trying to give myself permission as a writer and as a thinker to not apologize for my joy. Because I was writing at the same time that I was doing conventional academic things, right? So I was writing the articles and the more measured and the more, not less political, and not invested in a different project, but sort of certainly more controlled.
Mm.
And then it was reflecting Rogue. Well, Alma, first of all, my life is not as, like, yes, of course, you can't put everything into a book. It's impossible. But there aren't many salacious. There aren't, right? But I think for Reflecting Rogue, I wanted to write, yeah, I'd written Rape, A South African Nightmare. And it had done all this work that I didn't, that never occurred, that never would have occurred to me in a million years.
Mm.
But also, it had done this, it had become a big book, right? It won this award and did these things, and I was becoming the pain and violence and rape lady. And I was like, yes, that's important, but
I don't want it.
I'm also this incredibly nutty person. And also, yes, that's a big important part of feminism for me. But feminism is also the gifts have been the capacity to create rape and what is slavery to me and like those kinds of things. But the gift has also been in just who I'm, what I'm able to recognize and be drawn to when I see Little Honolo and Alma and Cheeky Natives and the beauty and the joy. My feminism is in the understanding and the rage and the anger and the commitment to create a new world at the big level. But it's also in like really silly things and being able to do and what I enjoy and what I love. And I wanted to write that kind of book. But also at a selfish writer level, I felt that as grateful as I was for Rape, I shouldn't write the next book that is the book that I'm trying to write now, Female Fear Factory. I needed to free myself. Because the thing is, it's like, now this book was such a sensation, Rape is an African Nightmare. People wanted me to write, like I was now gonna try and write another book. That was as big and important, but I didn't even know that I was. I don't know how to write a big and important book and be aware of it while I'm doing it.
Mm.
But now I was like, okay, so the next book is Female Fear Factory, and it has to be big and bold and important. And I was like, what the hell? does that mean? Like, what are you, like, what? So I thought, no, actually, I'm going to free myself. And so, and I also thought, you know, I'm going to write about personal things that are going to get me into trouble, I suppose. And so it was very, I'm glad that it reads like an exploration of joy, and I wanted to put in like the untidy bits, you know. I wanted to put in like the because I think sometimes people think that if the kind of person that writes a book like Rick, South African Nightmare, who works on slavery, is like walks through life with this absolute humorless, perfect, radical politics and perfect coherence and levels of disorganized, like, I thought, you know what, it's important, I'm human and I'm messy and I'm wonky and I like being wonky, and so there's also the gift of that. And so, yeah, I don't think I've answered what you offered. No, you did. That's my offering.
No, you did. And I liked what Amma says, because, like, this is the characterizations we had. I think in reflecting Rogue, it kept in touch with your feminist rogueness.
Mm-hmm.
So you were like, yes, I'm public, and yes, you want to know me, but I'm only going to allow you to a certain part of who I am.
Mm.
There are bits that I'm still going to keep to myself, mm-hmm. and that's fine. Like, you have no ownership over me. Because I feel like when you are a public figure, there's an ownership that belongs to you. And in reflecting Rogue, you're like, nah, nah, nah.
But there's also an ownership that's attached particularly to black women that we admire.
Yeah.
Right? There's a conversation that needs to be had about that, about why you feel so entitled to wanting to hear what Beyonce thinks about Colin Kaepernick taking the knee in ways that you may not have black men that you admire, right? And I really like what Prof was saying about how she wanted to show different characterizations, because people seem to think that if you are a black femme, it just sounds so funny to me. The other day, so they were surprised that I was like, I had this serious relationship and whatever. They're like, you are such a feminist, man. And I'm like, oh, I hate to break it to you, feminists fall in love, they get married too. I don't know if anybody's ever told you this. They just maybe keep their names, and maybe sometimes they don't, and they're still feminist, you know? And I think what Prof is saying is so true, that people expect that if your politics look a certain way, then it means that you are this one-dimensional person, and there's very little humanity extended to you, right? So there's not a sense of you being this multi-dimensional person who has interests, who has joys, who has anxieties outside of what your politics may be assumed to be. And it's just like a grace that's often not extended to black women, particularly black women that we admire. There's very little room for grace, right? There's very little room for us to be messy and to be problematic and to do things that may not always be reflective of what people think us to be.
Absolutely. But also, because I'm very old-fashioned. I'm a very old-fashioned feminist. Mm-hmm. I know that people think I'm like, but I'm a very old-fashioned feminist, right? So I really, and so, you know, when I realize often that when we think about the personal is political, that old slogan,
yes, Audrey,
people get so confused about what the personal is, right? That's the one thing. On the other hand, also, as a person who's a scholar of race, like who's a feminist scholar of race, I also know that part of how slavocracy and coloniality and the construction of white supremacy have worked is that they have constructed black people and all other racial others, and black women specifically, as perpetually available.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So now what does it mean for a black feminist who has a post-colonial and anti-colonial and anti-racist and critical race feminist politics write about the personal?
Yeah.
Right? It can't be, for me, it can't just be a project of exposure. Right? But at the same time, what does it mean to write about a feminist way of living and navigating the world that isn't in ways that pretend that there is no personal, right? And so, but also it's important for me to that distinction between the personal and the private You know, I mean, they overlap, they're sort of the same thing, but they're not. They're also very, very different. And sometimes people are interested in just like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Like a kind of tabloidy way, which is fine. It's just not my thing. Right?
Yeah.
And of course, people want me to write a memoir. But honestly, I'm not going to write a memoir. And as I often joke, but I'm not, I'm only half joking. You know, I'm 46 and I'm so happy that when I was in my 20s, cabinet phones did not have phones. Because there's certain things
that should stay in the 20s.
Some of which I barely remember. Are a blur. But also because it's a different project, right? It's not, but also I'm very clear. I think as I get old, maybe always, but maybe as I get older, I don't know which it is. I'm learning, and I'm trying to learn to be quite deliberate about my time, and to be quite deliberate about why I write. You know, because you can be asked. Sometimes you just want to write. Someone you like is doing a thing. And they're like, will you write? And sometimes you're just writing it because you like the person. And there's nothing wrong with that. But maybe it shouldn't be what, like, it isn't really what you want to be, you know? So I'm trying to be quite deliberate about, okay, what am I writing? Why am I writing? Because I've also realized that I know we're supposed to live to 100 years old now. But I don't, I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to have enough time to write all the books that I think are in my head.
And you need to be strategic about that.
I'm just thinking about joy, a little bit more about joy. There, in Reflecting Rogue, you speak about black, like, sisterhood, right? And it's, God, I don't know that we celebrate black sisterhood enough. Like, I think that there's some really, like, some popular critiques that go around, which are just so problematic about the ways in which women don't like each other, which is false, and we've seen it proven over and over again. But you write so beautifully about the ways in which your friends come together, you know, in raising your children, in supporting each other, in the ways in which women continuously prove to be each other's lifeline over and over again. And I found that to be such a beautiful, I was very grateful that she included that very personal, but like that very intimate bit about like friendships and the ways in which friendships have nourished you and have kept you going, and have, because we often just think like, you know, these women we admire just exist, like, you know, they come from somewhere, they just spring up and yay, I admire this woman. But we don't think about the importance of networks to support those women. We don't think about the importance of those women having places to go where they don't have to be black girl magic, where they don't have to have it together, where they can be human and messy and have things fall apart, and what that means for some of these women that we admire to have that.
And I think connected to that is the essay that you wrote in Feminism Is. Because the essay you wrote in Feminism Is was really elevating this feminist friendship, you know, and in the way that Danai writes about you in her Feeling and Ugly. And there's just this friendship. But this friendship is also like a feminist killjoy in some instance. It's like, fuck the patriarchy. And we are able to imagine alternative rearing and raising of children in our feminism.
Without having women's relationships centering men, right? Because somehow we always want to think that women relate to each other in relation to men, in relation to this like cishet romantic love. So your friends exist as an addendum to these romantic relationships.
And also, of course, we live in a country where we're told constantly 67% of children are living in single parent, right?
Yeah.
Many of which are women. And so, and yet we want to pathologize that, right? That's the one thing. So I was just like, no, what does it look like when we think about it as deliberate? And even if it's not deliberate, but we do something with it that is beautiful. But also, quite frankly, it is real, right? It is. I mean, the problem I had writing with that essay is that then I wanted, because there were so many people I wanted to put in there, and then some of the bits didn't write themselves, so some of the bits weren't beautiful enough, so then I took them out, right? It certainly wasn't, I'm glad that that was a good problem to have rather than a problem of like I don't have it. And yeah. I wanted to write that because I get incredibly irritated by the expectations placed on relationships between women, right? Mm. That they're supposed to be the be all and end all. Mm. Either so women can't be they're just human beings. Sometimes they're just awful people. And maybe the reason you can't stand these two men are not getting along is because these two human beings sometimes are not gonna like each other. It's not because but this burden that we have to be super women for each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get the flip side, which is women are always like out to get each other and it's the woman's fault and no kind of systemic analysis. But also, like you said, I just wanted to talk about what it enables, right? Because it's like you say, sometimes, so you have this life that has a degree of publicness, right? But it's as though I don't live at book clubs and book launches, right? And in order to be at those book clubs and book launches and book tours, as a person who's chosen very deliberately and very consciously to also be a parent in the world, and to be a very committed parent and a very present parent. Hello, it's not like then you have like other things. You need to build other things into that. It doesn't just all magically happen. And I'm always tickled, which is not my favorite thing. People always say, just bring your child. I'm like, but a child is like a human being. Like you can't just like you don't
just force.
That's not really a solution. Like, just bring your child. We'll provide childcare. That's the gesture is wonderful.
But
it's not like a handbag, like any childcare
is exactly.
Like, as long as you have a box, then I'm like, right? And I wanted, but also I wanted, it was kind of a love letter to those people as well who are choosing to do this work that allows us to do all of these things, which is hard work, but it's also because we've replicated in these ways, are able to create something that happens in many instances, right? But isn't named and isn't recognized as something worthy of writing about.
Mm.
And yet something that makes my life possible. Mm.
So thank you very much, Prof, for this absolutely enriching conversation. I feel so like enriched.
Yes.
Because, you know, we got to pick your brain on the episode of The Cheeky Natives. And I mean, as a loving fan of The Cheeky Natives, you know that we're supposed to give you some land, you know, because we're in the business of reparations.
Land.
Give me
land.
Yeah.
But before that, I just want to say that we didn't forget about your first baby. We love what slavery means to me.
Oh.
Like, so we just want people to know that we love all your
There's
work.
There's a whole conversation we wanted to have about memory and what memory looks like and what popular historical like revision of memory looks like as well, you know. Particularly this week with the death of, you know, an esteemed statesman for some and a dictator for the rest.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
Before we go to the land, where can people find you if people are interested in knowing more about you? Are you on the socials?
I'm on all the socials. I am. Oh no, not all. I'm not on Snapchat. I just can't figure out stuff. So I think it's anyway. I'm Pumla Dinelgola. I'm myself on Facebook. But I'm very weird on Facebook. So but you can follow me. People can follow me, and they can send me friendship requests. I am at @feminist_rogue on Twitter and Instagram. They're both open. And I'm sorry, I'm still working on my website. I mean, I've owned the domain name for over a decade, but I'm just really sloppy about approving the design. But I promise myself it will happen before my next birthday in 2.5 months. So and it's pumladinawa.co.za.
I'll let you give the land.
Yes. So we were looking at prime real estate, you know, because only the best will do for Prof. So after much deliberation at the Cheeky Natives, we sat and we really thought, you know, where can Prof go to just relax, you know, just take it easy, have beautiful seaside views while she works on her next book of many, because we know that she's an amazing 500 million books that Doc has. I was speaking in theme. So we've decided that we're going to give Prof a beautiful portion of land in Gunubi.
Because the Eastern Cape has, you know, so become many, home.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So Prof, the Eastern Cape has become home to Prof. But also because we know that the Eastern Cape needs Prof, you know. So we want her back in Joburg, but we're happy to lend her to the Eastern Cape for a little bit. But also just because seaside views for relaxation and for self-care are exactly what the doctor ordered.
Oh, thank you, Doctor.
So we look forward to giving you a beautiful piece of prime real estate in Gunubi where you can rest and relax and self-care and continue to do this amazing feminist work that you do that is so important, that has sparked so many conversations. I think we didn't even go into it. We could have had a 3-hour conversation with Prof just on Reflecting Rogue or just on A Renegade Named Simphiwe, you know, and or even rape, and that just speaks to the amazing work that Prof does in making the Academy accessible to people who may not necessarily be in it. I mean, I know lots of women who've read your book who aren't academics, who don't consider themselves scholars, who have felt that you gave them a language to express what had happened to them, what was happening to them, and what was problematic about some of the ways in which they feel violated by the society that they're in. And I think that is part of the importance of having black feminists in the academy who prioritize the kind of scholarly work that gives black women space and that gives black women room to name things and to have a language and to feel that the experiences are represented. So from the Cheeky Natives, thank you so much. We look forward to your next work. No pressure. It's very important to let Prof know that there is no pressure, but we cannot wait for your next work.
Thank you so much, Ilhokonolo and Alma, Cheeky Natives. And thank you for my land.
And I
accept and I am thrilled.
We can't wait.
And thank you so much for finally having me on Cheeky Natives.
I want to say, you've been speaking throughout Open Book, and one thing that's been ringing in my mind is a quote that I want to leave you with from Audre Lorde. He says, "I'm deliberate and afraid of nothing." Mm. And I feel you embody that a lot. And thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. I try.
Until next time, Cheeky Natives. Bye.